follow me down this deep, dark hole.
And welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer, as presented by the Morbidly Beautiful Network. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's podcast, I'm chatting to Jennifer Reeder about her involvement on VHS 94 as the writer and director of The Wraparound Story. Over the course of the interview, you will hear me talk to Jennifer about how she came on board this latest entry in the VHS franchise, the difficulties of filming in Toronto during a lockdown, and how this film proved a change of pace from her regular output. Plus, we discuss some of the stuff that didn't make it into the final cut of the movie, her thoughts on the found footage subgenre, and how horror is now more than ever providing an authentic representation of its audience. All of which, and much more, you can hear right now in my interview with Jennifer.
Thanks, Scott, for having me. It's really nice to be back.
So, we've got you on to talk about, a few things, but mainly VHS 94, which just recently went up on Shudder. And so, first of all, I was going to ask you, were you already a fan of the VHS franchise before you were offered this?
No, that's my real answer. I wouldn't say that it was maybe that sounded harsh. I was not, I had seen them, but I wasn't none of the films in that franchise were on any of my kind of general top tens. You know, I sometimes have, I'm not somebody who as a consumer even loves the found footage format always. You know, I think it can be so hit or miss. I mean, there's ones that I really love, and there's some that I just, they make me a little motion sick sometimes, So it's not something that I seek out in general, there's a new found footage horror anthology, VHS or not VHS. I had definitely seen them. And I think I felt, one of the reasons I said yes when I was asked to be part of it was because I felt that the kind of previous VHSs, and the producers know that I feel this way, but the previous VHSs seemed so kind of maybe macho is a polite word, or sort of bro driven, and kind of in a space where there's sort of, room for, girls in underwear either killing or being killed, or I don't know, tropes that as a consumer who's also a filmmaker, it's easy to sort of, watch something else instead, to use my time and energy to watch something else instead. When they asked me, I thought oh, that's a pivot, you've got my attention. And I immediately then sort of watched them all again, kind of in a, back to back to back.
And so when you were having that discussion, this is really interesting there. When you're having that discussion with the producers, which I'm taking your talk to Dave Bruckner and mm-hmm. Silence guys or whatever.
Right.
Did they admit themselves that as a franchise, it does have a particular kind of focused towards like a young male audience. There is a kind of masculine, kind of bro-y vibe to, well, the two films that I saw. I never watched VHS Viral, but I watched the first two. Mm-hmm. Were they kind of seeing that themselves? And is that like why they approached you?
I mean, I would, you know, I actually was approached kind of late in the game. So speaking of David Bruckner, you know, he was the one who was actually supposed to direct the wraparound, and he got called off to do Hellraiser. And so, you know, they were looking for the fifth director and someone to do the wraparound. They had obviously already attached Chloe Okuno, who had already finished her section. She had already shot in her section, and it was in post-production when I was approached. And you know, it seemed very much as though, you know, there's a lot of directors that they could have approached. And it seems like, yeah, that there was a, I mean, I'm not just a, I like to think of myself as not just a, you know, female writer and director, but a female writer and director who has a real specific point of view in terms of, you know, female empowerment and kind of gender representation. So I think when a team like this approaches me, that they're prepared for questions like, okay, well, you know, can I rewrite the script and inject it with some, you know, some feminism? And, you know, they were all like, absolutely, you know, do you. So I felt, so that, you know, that felt like, that felt like a real pivot. And, you know, I would say that the prior VHSs, you know, all those guys and the other guys, you know, Adam Wingard and some of the other people that were involved earlier on, they're all just friends, you know, so like good friends in real life. And the previous VHSs were made on, you know, less than a shoestring of a budget. So it wasn't, you know, I understood even prior to them approaching me for this one that, you know, those films were like friends making films together. You know, there was not a moment where they sat around and made a decision to exclude female voices by any means. But I think that when they had this opportunity to make, you know, a more substantial VHS contribution with Shudder involved, a bigger budget, you know, shooting in Canada, you know, just some, you know, kind of heftier production design, creature design. You know, I think that they sort of paused and thought, okay, let's curate these directors in a way that also makes, you know, VHS 94 stand out a bit and be more kind of reflective of the filmmaking, the contemporary filmmaking landscape, which includes lots of diverse voices in horror and, you know, other genre.
And mm-hmm. I was wondering in terms of like the construction of your short. Now, obviously in an anthology movie, the wraparound is generally seen as the most thankless task because mm-hmm. you've got to work around a bunch of other stories, and it's usually the story that people least want to do.
That remains true.
So why what was the inspiration of you taking it on and kind of knowing that, you know, having seen a bunch of anthology movies and knowing that fact?
I've seen other horror anthologies, some that have, you know, the most minimal wraparound. It's just something like, you know, mm-hmm. title cards or something. Yeah. Other ones that have a slightly heftier kind of story involved, ones that are not at all related to the shorts, etc. And you know, the funny thing is that I read a version of the script in which that David Bruckner had written a draft of the wraparound that actually was, you know, had a narrative arc and character development. So I was thinking of it as another short that simply was kind of cut up into, you know, tiny, you know, episodes that would burst onto the screen in between the shorts. And You know, I got advice from Radio Silence and from, you know, Adam Hendricks of Divide and Conquer, who had also done one of the wraparounds. I mean, they were all, once I said yes and the contract was signed, that's when the calls started coming in saying, like, you know, that the wraparound is notoriously the least liked section of not just, you know, the VHS anthologies, but so many anthologies. You know, I hope that you are up to the challenge of you know, sort of being, you know, the least appreciated. And, you know, I was like, yeah, no problem. I mean, it's like my kind of punk roots. I'm like, it's fine. I'm an anarchist. It's like, you know, I'm used to being on the outside. I'm a misfit. I don't mind, you know, like give me the misfit section. But I definitely, you know, when one of the things that I said it was David Bruckner, Brad Miska, Josh Goldblum, and Chad of Radio Silence. I said, you know, I got two scripts. I got one that David Bruckner had written and one that Simon Barrett had written, both that were none of which were fleshed out. They would both tell you that they were both a little flimsy, but they both kind of had this idea of like a SWAT team that raids a kind of a warehouse that they think is a kind of a drug super lab. And it's something else. That was actually what I wanted to preserve, because I've not made anything like that, you know? And I thought, oh, this is kind of interesting. I'd love to, you know, think about, take on a SWAT team, which is like so masculine. The cast had already been attached. There were two women attached, and I was like, oh, heck yeah, I'm going to figure out, you know, I'm going to rewrite their storylines, entirely, you know, cause I want to think about, you know, what's the trajectory of these, you know, two lady SWATs. And I said, you know, when I got attached, I said, I want to rewrite that section. You know, I want to do something that feels like the wraparound is a short in itself, where when the audience comes back to it, you know, they are curious about those characters as well. I mean, you know, I have to be real, like, how it exists right now, how the wraparound exists right now is actually very different than from what I wrote and what I shot and what started out in post-production. There's a whole beginning section that got lopped off, and there's a whole end, another kind of like end beat that got lopped off, kind of mostly in the service of not making the wraparound too complicated, honestly. You know, I think that at some level, maybe the producers were like, okay, we're going to make the wraparound more complicated than it has been, but let's not make it as complicated as you know, had anticipated. So, you know, I do think that there's a little bit of like the wraparound as it exists right now that has kind of suffered a little bit from just what the other shorts do, which is like, you know, sort of pornography on some level. You know, it's like, let's get to the gore. You know, we don't need to see people standing around and talking. Let's kind of like get to the gore. And I get it. That's part of like the franchise. That's what the fans expect. You know, but I also come from a world that's like, okay, so fans expect one thing, but if you give them something else, maybe they'll expect that the next time. So, it was an interesting, you know, going through the post-production process, putting the whole thing together was an interesting kind of negotiation and compromise.
I was going to ask about that, because I was going to say, is this the goriest project you've ever been attached to? Because having seen Knives and Skin and some of your shorts, it seems like that would be the case. You know, it's not your usual bag.
Oh yeah, no doubt. I mean, look, I definitely lean into bleeding bodies, to pools of blood, to dead bodies. But they, you know, in my previous films, they sort of exist as these, you know, like iconic, like allegorical images. They're not always meant to be so literal. And so, with this, I sort of loved, you know, I loved writing and shooting that kind of end bludgeoning. I loved working with the DOP who helped shoot that, and the actor who was doing the bludgeoning, who in real life is a very small woman. I mean, just meaning that it seems like if you saw her in real life, you would think, I'm not sure she could, she's capable of doing that physically, you know, physics of it, the biology of it. But I loved empowering.
I mean, it is the movies, you know, I mean, like,
it's Tom true.
Cruise, Tom Cruise is like 5'7" in real life.
Yeah, you know, exactly. You know what I mean? Exactly. Let's be really real, you know? So, but it felt fun. It felt like really fun to kind of empower that actor and to do something that just, you know, felt kind of like, you know, shooting it was not impulsive. It was choreographed within an inch of its life, but, you know, shooting something that, you know, on the screen just felt, you know, like, I think the VHS fans and the gore fans are really going to love this moment. And working with, you know, like the special effects team in Canada to sort of like, you know, build the kind of aftermath of the bludgeoning, you know, which was, you know, so gory and great. Yeah, it was fun. I mean, I'm not sure. Well, I take that back. You know, I think that there's the film that I'm set to shoot here in Chicago in March of 2022 has some kind of proper gore also. It's in a different kind of a, you know, it's definitely, you know, it's in a different sort of a context, but yeah, that was actually way more fun than I had expected.
When you say it's in a different sort of a context, do you mean like it's more kind of serious, like, well, less kind of goofy gore?
Yeah. It's more, I mean, I definitely think that, you know, that the whole, I don't know that the producers would agree with me, but I do think that actually the whole of the VHS franchise in 94 is no exception, but there's a lot of like camp. I mean, it's not, no, camp, not in the kind of queer sense, you know, but like, there's like, it's campy. It's like horror camp, you know, or campy horror or something. I mean, it kind of knows what it is, you know? I mean, I love Chloe's, you know, Ratma monster, you know, but it's got like some great kind of, you know, camp horror, and Simon's kind of, you know, zombie guy, you know, and Timo's section is just so flipping wild. This kind of Frankenstein, mad doctor. I mean, it's, you know, we're not, it's not dramatic horror, you know, it's not, it's not something that's like somebody would say like, well, if you're obsessed with like Seven, you know, then you'll love VHS 94, you know, it's a really, you know, yeah. It's in a different kind of like, you know, it's in a different kind of like that, the kind of classic horror realm, which I think is also, you know, really cool. You know, I agree
with you. It's kind of fun, trashy, black comic kind of horror, which is, you know, I'm not shitting on that. You know, it exists in the kind of same realm as something like Frank Henelotter films, you know, like Basket Cases.
Yes, that, totally. You know, like
And that has its place in horror, and I'm totally for that, you know. And if if you want that vibe, you go for that, and if you want another vibe, you go for another thing.
But the film that I'm shooting in March definitely has, I mean, the kind of gore that's part of that sort of airs more on the side of you know, I mean, to sort of like have like, I mean, you know, airs more on the side of kind of like the 78 version of Carrie meets like Saint Maud or something like that. You know, it's just got like, you know, it's just got some more, it's just a little more emotionally grounded. Mm-hmm. sort of psychologically grounded. You know, it's like the gore is grounded in the provenance of the, you know, the kind of characters in sort of emotional arc. You know, I mean, thinking about something like Raw, you know, and the gore in Raw is really, is just rooted in that character's, you know, story. It's not something that that feels, you know, like a laughable moment, you know, or like a moment where everyone's like, you know, wow, look at that, or has like a reaction, you know, that is kind of like a sort of ecstatic, you know, reaction.
Yeah. I mean, it's totally different. I very much get that. You know, it's like you watch, you know, for example, Timo's short in VHS 94, and you're seeing like heads explodes and stuff like that, and you're like, oh, look at that. But then you watch something something like the bit in Raw where the guy wakes up with a bit of his leg missing, and you're like, Jesus Christ. It's this very different realm of gore and what the... what the vibe is.
Exactly.
Definitely brace myself for your film then, because like, you know, you mentioned like Saint Maud there. The final shot of Saint Maud traumatized me for
It's so brilliant. You know, I mean, I just have to give a shout out to like my UK sisters, you know, not just Rose Glass, but, you know, Preno, you know, Bailey Bond, who both of whom, you know, I consider, you know, friends, even though we've not met in person, you know, and I'm just like, I'm so into what's happening right now, you know, just even between the two of them and Saint Maud and Censor, you know, it's just a very, yeah, and you know, Julie's Raw and then Titane is just like blowing up, you know, I just am like, so.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing Titane. I've not seen it yet. I've heard loads of amazing things since.
That's right. The same is for me as well. I haven't seen it yet. It was like it screened at Fantastic in Austin the night before I arrived. Yeah, and I just think it's, you know, I mean, I would go back to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, you know, which was released when she was a teenager, and say, you know, women have kind of dominated scary stories for a long time. But what's happening right now with you know, women in genre, especially the kind of horror thriller, you know, kind of psychological, surreal, fantastical, it's so cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's been amazing in the last certainly in the last few years, like in Raw, Censor, Saint Maud, you know, some of her horror films the last few years. So it's definitely. It's blown up for women in horror, and it's fascinating to see the kind of different takes on horror, and it being more diversified. There seems to be a lot more female voices, more queer voices, more international voices that are not just like American or British or whatever. So like, yeah, it's great. It's a great to be in horror.
No, it's crazy. I mean, I would also say just kind of like, you know, the from like, you know, Jennifer Kent's Babadook to her, you know, Nightingale, which was extraordinary, to thinking about, you know, Maddie Diop's Atlantics, you know, which is really a kind of a ghost story, you know, possession story, even though that might not be something that someone thinks of as genre immediately, but I think of it as a really beautifully elevated genre film. To even right now, you know, like Nia DaCosta's Candyman, you know, is getting these great reviews, and you know, I couldn't agree more that it's such a great time for not just the people who are the writers and the directors, but, you know, when I was touring around with Knives and Skin, which I think of as something that's like genre adjacent, you know, it borrows from horror, but it's not a horror, and it borrows from, you know, the musical, but it's not a musical, you know, it borrows from thriller, but it's not exactly a thriller. But what I experienced directly, especially in the festival touring, during the festival tour, was that there were so many, let's say, like young women of color in the audience, you know, who just, I think you know, I mean, came because they saw like that there was a woman who had written and directed something that was kind of, you know, that maybe was being programmed in the genre section, the midnight section, getting genre press, whatever. And maybe they had seen the promotional still of, you know, my actor, Irian Roach, who's this beautiful African-American actor, you know, who's the kind of lead young woman, if you could call a lead for an ensemble cast. And they showed up and were just so, you know, deeply like thankful that they could see, you know, someone who looked like them in a film like this, and they survived the whole film, and they were, you know, they got to be, you know, as weird as they wanted to be, kind of gothy, punky, nerdy, heroic, whatever. You know, and so I think of all of this authentic representation. I don't always like the word diverse, because it's really just, you know, the world, you know, if you cast your film authentically, then there's a variation of people in front of the camera, different sizes, different colors, different. And, you know, what I've learned is that genre fans are also a wide variation, different. And, you know, those super genre fans who are not the kind of straight white cis bros deserve some representation on screen, and not just as supporting characters or as the people being stalked or killed.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And I like your definition there about like authentic instead of diverse, because I agree as well. You know, I mean, I am a straight white male myself, but, you know, it's cisgender. But I think for a long time it was kind of viewed as like horror nerds are that, you know, that's not the case. Like most of the horror fans, there's a fairly equal split in the horror fans I know between male, female, you know, different. So yeah, it's just not the case. And we are seeing a more authentic landscape of the different people who engage with horror. So kind of coming back to VHS 94, just something you said earlier on in the interview about the kind of truncated form that your short exists within the finished film that is currently on Shudder. Were you, like, when you first saw it on screen, were you disappointed by that? That, like, stuff had just been kind of chucked out?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't. You know, I knew that was going to happen before I saw it on screen, you know, and the first time that I saw a cut, you know, like I had been making cuts, and then the producers, you know, were like, we want to kind of make a pass to sort of kind of speed things up, you know? And so I was like, okay. And then the first time I saw their cut, I was really disappointed is maybe a polite way of saying how I felt. Cause I think that there's some, there's some content and some context that, you know, that got lost. And, I've made so many films, you know, this, I've made so many films. And I always know there's a moment when you have to, you know, look at a scene that you love and be like, I love you scene, but I need to cut you loose. You know, like there's lots of hard decisions that one has to make as a filmmaker, you know, to kind of get to the story, to maybe deal with a timeline length constraint or whatever. But this one just felt, you know, it was hard to let a couple of things go, because like I said before, I was really trying, you know, I really wanted the wraparound. And I didn't lose everything by any means, but, you know, I was really trying to, with the wraparound, provide a kind of meta narrative that, contextualized not just the shorts in VHS 94, but maybe even the entire franchise of VHS 94. You know, I mean, I was going very much for a kind of feminist Videodrome. I love David Cronenberg, and I think Videodrome is oh gosh, I don't know if I should go on record saying that's my favorite, because I'm gonna be like, no, but I like Dead Ringers and I like Scanners and, you know, Existence. But there's something that's like, so as a filmmaker, there's something that I, you know, approaching VHS 94, I was like, oh wow, okay, hold on. What if this, like, it's a SWAT raid, but it's not a super drug lab. It's this kind of underground, you know, unrated video, you know, like video production soundstage, kind of a thing. Kind of like, what is the suggestion in, you know, in Videodrome on some level, and other, you know, other Super 8 or other, you know, like films that are just not nearly as interesting as Videodrome. Yeah. So, but at the same time, I did get to talk back into the, you know, the final cut moments that I thought really needed to be in there, you know. So, you know, there was a big kind of lop off, and then there were conversations, like slowly bringing moments back in that we were, you know, on both sides able to like kind of compromise and negotiate.
Well, I mean, does that include the final moment? I don't want to give anything away, spoiler wise.
No, I mean, no, they loved the final moment. There's another, there was a different beat of an ending. Mm-hmm. That I loved and that they didn't. And I get it, you know, I will. But, you know, the best part is that I wrote that ending and I get to use it. It's mine, you know, in my brain. It's my own intellectual property. So, you know, I get to put that ending into another film.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah, for sure. I know exactly what you mean. And there's still like there's still those some of those standout beats, like the final moment. And this isn't a spoiler because it happens early on. One of the bits of the movie that made me laugh the most was which is kind of sick, like because at first it's kind of like, oh, it's a gory moment because you see this guy. He's got his eyes gouged out, but then mm-hmm. one of the SWAT team just goes like, oh, I know that guy, he works mm-hmm. at my local video store, and it just yeah. for some reason just really tickled me.
Yeah, and I feel like that's really, if someone has seen my films before, I feel like that's such a Jennifer Reeder moment on some level, you know, that you approach something that feels like people are going to react one way, and then they react a different, you know, their reaction is something that's, you know, quite unexpected, which I really do think happens in real life. You know, I mean, this is going to seem like such an odd comparison, but in Martin Scorsese's The Departed, you know, which is not also one of his best films, but there's a kind of a scene early on when like the Jack Nicholson character, you know, kind of assassinates two people, and the man falls, and the woman kind of falls on top of the man after she's been shot, and it's brutal. But then Jack Nicholson's character says, oh, she fell funny, you know? And I thought, oh my God, that's so, and I had already done stuff like that before in my films, but I was like, oh, okay, great. So there's like a little, there's a moment where Martin Scorsese and I, you know, would have something to talk about to say, like, that's an interesting little moment where you imagine that a character is going to react one way. Because I thought that, I mean, whatever, I thought that too. The moment that I saw that film, I was like, oh, that's a strange, like, why would she felt funny? And then the character's like, she felt funny. And so, yeah, I mean, someone not that long ago said that my films don't have round edges. And he suggested that, you know, when you think a beat in one of a scene is going to go this way, it just goes the other way. It kind of takes a sharp turn. It doesn't kind of like follow the curve of a scene. And that's accurate, you know, so it felt really good. And the Rodrigo, who plays Spivey, that actor is a comedian. He does lots of comedy. Mm-hmm. And once I knew that he had been cast, I was like, oh, well, I have to give him some funny lines. And he actually has he has a lot of like funny punchlines in the wraparound. You know, he's also the one that says something like, you know, if this makes it onto TV, I could do the interview. I have a face for, you know, I have a face for TV or whatever. Oh, if this makes the news or, you know, he has some really funny, I mean, there's levels of funniness in it, but I just thought that I wanted him to be this kind of, you know, the officer who makes the sort of off observations.
Yeah. Yeah. I was also, in terms of like the actual filming, I was wondering, you know, obviously we're all living under COVID conditions, and how difficult was that for filming, like, you know, filming under like COVID protocols?
Well, so, you know, like I mentioned before the interview, you know, officially began, I had to go to Toronto for, you know, an extra 14 days to quarantine, which was, you know, kind of an interesting experience to go someplace, quarantine for 14 days, then like prep for, you know, 6 days and shoot for 5 days, you know, then fly out the day after, you know, we had wrapped, you know, principal photography. And when I got to Toronto, the whole of Ontario was back into a shelter in place because it had been such an uptick in COVID cases. And so, for instance, you know, when I would have conversations with the hair and makeup team or the, you know, the costume designer, you know, just to get like a pack of undershirts, like white undershirts, normally, you know, the costume designer could go to a kind of a big box store. I mean, on the one hand, like fuck big box stores, but she could go to a big box store and just buy a pack of undershirts. But the big box stores in Ontario during this time had taken everything off of the shelves that they didn't think were essential. So you could go in and you get food, or you could get like pharmaceuticals, but you couldn't get a pack of t-shirts. So everything had to be ordered and shipped, which everybody across Ontario was getting everything ordered and shipped. So there were, and including, you know, then the hair and makeup team, you know, needed some blood that they could put in people's eyes. And normally they would go to the makeup store, but the makeup store was closed because that was not considered essential. Mm-hmm. And so they had to, or the, you know, whatever, the special effects makeup store was closed. And so they had to order, and everything was delayed. I mean, thank goodness, you know, everything arrived just in the nick of time, or someone was like, I think a friend has some eye blood, I'll go pick it up, you know. But it was also like, do they have an eye blood that has never been opened, you know, because we're also not going to put an eye blood dropper near someone's eye at a time during a communicable disease outbreak. So God, it was like the layers of the twists and turns, you know, Scott Murphy, were just endless, you know. But once we started shooting, it was not hard at all. Actually, once we started shooting, all the cast and crew bubbled up in the same hotel, so that, you know, because we would get COVID tests, you know, almost every day during the kind of 5 days of shooting and even the prep prior to. So it was really important, you know, you don't want a quick shoot like that to be halted because someone comes back COVID positive. So everyone had to kind of like stay quarantined together while we were shooting. I mean, quarantined in the same hotel. We were all separated in different rooms, of course. It was kind of great, you know, passing somebody in the hallway who was going to go do their laundry, you know, and, you know, having a quick hello, or, you know, I don't know that I kind of loved it. It was like film camp on some level, but you know, once we started, you know, once we were like on set, you know, obviously everyone was wearing masks. You know, there was a COVID compliance officer on set, so to say, who made sure that, you know, in between takes, people separated, you know, got hand sanitizer, had their masks on, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that part actually wasn't hard and wasn't bad. And parts of that I would love to kind of continue, you know, because I think that sometimes on a film set, you know, towards like the 11th hour, you know, people just start kind of getting crowding around each other and, you know, sick people come to set and then everybody gets sick. And I don't know, I just think that there's actually some things to learn from this experience. You know, do we need that many people on set? Do we need that many people right there on the scene? You know, like who's touching what, you know, and, you know, especially with food, like, can we make sure that like people, there's not multiple people touching food or there's not, you know, I just think that there's ways to take what we've learned, but it was definitely, you know, it wasn't just extraordinary during COVID times, but going into shooting in Toronto where Ontario was at a shelter in place was like an extra layer of, you know, obstacles.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds very challenging indeed. But it is interesting though, that it's kind of made you think and made you kind of being like, oh, going forward, I might take some of this.
Mm-hmm. Yep, for sure.
Yeah. What would you say filming were the greatest challenges outside of the COVID protocols?
Honestly, it was like getting, I mean, I feel like you'll appreciate this. In so many of my scripts, I can't even count the times that I have written, while I've been writing a script, that I have written the word cunnilingus, for instance. And yet I have never, this is the first time I've ever written shots fired.
You know? Yeah, I guess.
So kind of like figuring out how to like SWAT teams move in formation. What is SWAT lingo? You know, like what, I mean, that kind of, you know, like SWAT banter is just, it's so foreign to me. It was like writing a foreign language, you know, and I had to, you know, some of it was speculation. Some of it was borrowing from what David Bruckner had written. His father was in law enforcement for a long time. And so I think that some of the stuff he had gotten from just kind of hearing his dad talk. And then some of it was like a deep dive down, you know, YouTube body cam footage, you know, of SWAT raids, which honestly, there's more kind of small talk than I had imagined, you know, like more kind of like, you know, police search warrant. Oh, like, oh, Jim, your shoe's untied, or just like, you know, this guy was very, so I think that the challenge was, you know, writing and directing a kind of language and choreography that's very foreign to me. And yeah, then that kind of bludgeoning at the end, was that actually wasn't as hard as I thought it would be, because I've done similar things, people getting hit with things, you know, where you have to kind of choreograph the throwing of the thing and then when the blood comes, etc. Some of that, and you know, nobody got to sing, you know, there were some other things that I just missed. I was like, there's no teenagers, nobody sings, you know. But I felt like I had a lot of freedom, honestly, to sort of deal with a kind of the garish color palette that I love, and to lean into. I thought that being able to that super glitchy Betamax kind of archiving that we used, you know, is it's an extension of, you know, the kind of surreal, dreamy, superimposition, floaty things that I've used in my films before. You know, mm-hmm. that felt like being able to kind of disrupt the visual image was awesome. I mean, I would do that again. I would make a project again. You know, maybe not that was shot like found footage, but maybe that was meant to feel like it was shot entirely with like a Betamax.
Yeah.
You know,
I was kind of wondering about camera. That. I was kind of mm-hmm. wondering like how that was achieved, that kind of grainy VHS mm-hmm. look, if that was something like you filmed one way, but that was kind of, that grain was kind of added in post, or like what, like how that was done.
So we shot with an Arri Alexa, you know, we shot with a beautiful contemporary digital camera mm-hmm. and then it gets run through an actual tape transfer, you know, so it actually runs through, you know, transfers to tape and back. And Andrew Appel, who was the DOP for this project, and I both loved the Betamax, tape transfer look. And because right. it had lots of that, you know, crunchy, grimy archiving. Some of the other filmmakers like Simon Barrett, I know, really wanted to preserve a lot of the background in his section. So he had a different way of approaching, you know, kind of archiving the footage. But God, I loved how crunchy and mushy and muddy the image got. I mean, my background is in video art. You know, I began with, you know, working in analog video. So all of those glitches, all that vertical roll, the pixelization, I love it. It's just entire, it's really in my DNA as a filmmaker, you know, absolutely. So the process was pretty meticulous, you know, and then, you know, in theory, right, this is the footage is supposed to feel like it's continuous video footage, like it's amateur, yeah. you know, behind the camera. But of course you can make edits, and you make edits with glitches. But still, I love, you know, I love these little, you know, breaks in the signal, you know, it's really fantastic. I mean, I think that it's all still pretty fresh, and I've got, you know, projects lined up already, but I want to figure out how to marry, you know, my rigidness towards, you know, kind of meticulous cinematography with, you know, fat, grimy, pixelated, glitchy footage. So watch out for that. I don't know when that's going to happen, but I'm going to, but I loved it. I actually love the texture of this whole project. I love the texture of it so much.
Yeah. I think it was, I really like that kind of, the 90s aesthetic of the thing, you know, I suppose growing up in the 90s.
well, but also, you know, but thinking about the 90s, you know, what I also loved about, you know, when the producers approached me about VHS 94, you know, I mean, I think it could certainly be the case all over the world, honestly, but I was thinking about, you know, specifically in 1994, that there were a lot of events that took place in the US in particular, that we have a recollection of because they were shot with amateur video. So for instance, you know, the OJ Simpson, you know, white Bronco chase, the Branch Davidian, you know, like Waco fire, you know, where the FBI invaded this kind of church cult in Waco, mm-hmm. Texas, or the Olympic skater, Nancy Kerrigan, you know, Tanya Harding's ex-husband, you know, hit her in the knee as she was coming off ice. I mean, we have all of this, and Kurt Cobain's suicide, you know, we have footage of, you know, neighbors looking into his house. We have footage of memorials all over the country, all over the world, of Kurt Cobain's funeral, you know, and memorials. So I, you know, without violating copyright infringement, there's some of those glimpses of footage in my section, you know, so if you're looking at it, you also, I really wanted to try to incorporate VHS footage from 1994, where a lot of very substantial cultural moments happened, but we only know that they happened, or our memory of those happening is entirely formulated through amateur video footage that was broadcast.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that while watching it, but yes, I remember, you know, those were all events that happened when I was a child, and I still remember that, and it was just obviously they've been repeated a bunch as well. So yeah, absolutely. I did want to compliment you as well on and the film in general, because I am not the biggest fan of found footage either. But I did think that you passed the hurdle, and the other shorts passed the hurdle, which I think is the greatest challenge of found footage, and that is the question, why are they still filming? And in each case, I think there's a reason that the camera is still on, because some found footage movies, I'm just like, I know a lot of people love Cloverfield, for example, but I just, in that film, I'm just like, why is this still happening? Why are these people still filming this? I don't, there's a giant monster running, like just dump the camera and run away. You know,
Yeah, I agree. And right. And I think that, you know, I think that in, you know, I think that, that in this one in particular, you know, I know that Simon was thinking about like the context of the camera, you know, this kind of like two camera setup in a funeral home, and that, you know, at some point the, you know, the woman who's kind of stewarding or shepherding that wake is not even so much aware of the camera, and she does put it down at some point, but it's still recording. You know, and you've got kind of, you know, Chloe's kind of camera person, and, you know, Ryan has just this like, you know, militia who's constantly, you know, just documenting their own movements. And of course, like Timo's section, I mean, the camera is the monster, you know, which is so rad. I mean, in my section, honestly, there's also a moment where that's not in the final version where the camera person gets shot. And then one of the lady SWATs takes over, you know, operating the camera, you know, and that you kind of see that happening, but it's unclear like why the original camera person is down, which is frustrating to me. But I absolutely thought about that as well, you know, because I think that now very contemporarily, you know, when we've got all sorts of like, you know, cell phone footage of horrible things happening, and you know, that footage ends at some point because someone drops their camera and goes to help the person, or they drop their camera and, you know, different things happen, or, you know, there's that moment of it goes dark because the person is authentically, genuinely reacting to the crisis at, you know, surrounding them. So yeah, that was that, sometimes that logic, that wasn't that, those were also interesting conversations with the producers, you know, sometimes the logic when we were getting into the final stages of post, you know, where what bothered me didn't bother them, and what bothered them didn't bother me. You know, there were just these things like in terms of the kind of like the logic of who has the camera now, and why do they still have the camera, you know, et cetera. But
I get that because like it's, I think everybody has like their own different angle on it. And like, it's like, you know, when I'm watching a found footage, it bothers me if like people are like filming when I think they shouldn't be filming. And yet the logic of like, how did these tapes get collected from these disasters? Like, you know, that doesn't bother me. I'm like, yeah, they just exist. That's fine. I'm happy with that. You know, like...
Oh yeah, no doubt. Yep, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. somebody else might be bothered by that. They'd be like, well, who retrieved these tapes? Like, what's going on here?
Well, here's the thing that I will tell you. So at the beginning, so my section, the way that I wrote it and shot it, it started out with a one of the SWAT team guys kind of off duty finding an abandoned van full of like bloody VHS tapes that were all labeled identically that said, holy hell, you know, like we literally filled this huge or like a conversion van, you know, I don't know how to describe that. Maybe that doesn't translate, but it's like a kind of a 1970s era, you know, van that's got like carpet on the ceiling of the van.
All right. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, not like a caravan trailer, but a kind of, and not like a Volkswagen, but you know what I mean? It's like, a Cheech and Chong kind of van.
Yeah. I know what you mean.
So the beginning was supposed to start with this, like this cop, you know, one of the SWAT officers kind of off duty comes across this abandoned van. And there's kind of blood on the van, there's blood on the ground, and he opens up the back door and out spills this, you know, hundreds of videotapes. They're all identical that say, holy hell. And I loved that moment. Now that got jettisoned, you know? That bums me out because I think that sets out something that says, you know, yeah, where are all these, you know, that the videotapes were commodity, you know, that someone stole, you know, hundreds and hundreds of videotapes from someone else and they were killed for them. You know, like, I don't know, there's something that's like, yeah, unbelievable about that. But also like, yeah, what is on those videotapes that's so, you know, that someone would kill for, you know, and the idea of, you know, again, like Videodrome, this kind of sense of like, the video signal as, narcotic on some level. And I do think that that's still relevant right now. You know, I mean, I didn't want to get too like heady with what I was doing, but, I have small children who consume disgusting amounts of like TikTok and, you know, Instagram reels or like YouTube. And, I know that I need, it's like, it's not like I don't have any control over that. I'm not saying like, I have no control over what they watch, but it is like a drug. And I didn't have that when I was young. I mean, maybe you had some of that, but, you know, it wasn't, it's
yeah,
like,
it wasn't as prevalent. I mean, like, you know, I was born in 1985. I grew up in the 90s. We didn't have like, internet in my house until I was about 15, and we had like dial-up internet when we got it, so like it, you know, it took about three days to download an image, so like
right. And I think that, and I do, and I do think that you know, I mean, I as an adult person and filmmaker, I get totally suckered into some of those like Instagram reels, you know, like husky dogs, you know, howling, or someone making a miniature burrito for a hamster. I mean, the dumbest stuff, but it's at a certain time in the day, I'm just like mesmerized. And it's like a 1 minute, and then that it moves. I mean, it is kind of hypnotic, narcotic. So I also, you know, really wanted to this section to feel like, even though it's taking place in 1994 and it's kind of talking about, you know, hypnotic, narcotic video signals, I wanted it to resonate, you know, to what's happening right now, the kind of the cult of Facebook, even. I mean, there was an ex-Facebook CEO that just testified in front of, you know, I think, you know, like the Supreme Court around, you know, Facebook practices, algorithms, et cetera. And that's completely, from my perspective, that is 100% relevant to what I was trying to do with the wraparound, you know, to really talk about signal manipulation, information manipulation, And I'm sure that, you know, the right at this moment, the average person, you know, watching VHS 94 is not kind of necessarily being like, well, wow, this is, this reminds me that I just saw that, you know, an ex Facebook CEO talking about, you know, information manipulation, but I know, and I'm telling you that that's what I was, you know, that that's what I was also thinking about.
And now my audience knows as well. So is that a, couple more, a few more people are informed too. So I like, as we kind of, bring this interview to a close. You mentioned something you will be filming next year, also for Shudder. Can you tell us anything about that, or do you want to mainly keep that under your hat?
No, I can tell you. I can tell you about both of the projects that I. Well, I did a. So like I said, I shot a film actually this summer after I returned from Canada. I shot a film that's called Night's End. Which is also a Shudder original. It's a kind of, it was all Chicago based cast and crew, including, Michael Shannon. And it's, a kind of a, like a shut in ghost exorcism story. So it's about an adult male, which I've never made a film that the protagonist was an adult man he's got these kind of shut in tendencies. He moves into a new apartment in a new town, kind of trying to get a fresh start from, you know, a divorce. He's a single dad as well. And his new apartment is haunted. So it's a kind of a chamber piece. We shot it miraculously over 13 days here in Chicago. Yeah. And, it's in post-production. And then I'm shooting a film in March of 2022 called Perpetrator. That's also, being shot here in Chicago, that is produced by, What the Films, which is a Paris-based company, as well as Divide and Conquer here in the US, and 30 West also here in the US. And I can't say the cast that are attached, but it's an incredible cast. And I would only say that it's a kind of a nuanced coming of age. Like I said, Carrie before, it's like a kind of a Carrie meets Cat People.
Okay.
Right. And I said Carrie meets St. Maude, which is not, which is also sort of true. It's like Carrie meets Cat People, the Natasha Kinski Cat People with,
that one. Yeah. Yeah.
I love that one. You know, I mean, I know that there's an earlier one, but the Natasha Kinski is my favorite one. Yeah. Malcolm McDowell. So it's a real nuanced kind of, you know, coming of age shapeshifter project, which for me feels like a very organic follow-up to Knives and Skin. I mean, Perpetrator is, it's actually not an ensemble cast. It's got one, you know, lead. It's much more kind of causally driven. It's a full genre film. It's not genre adjacent. And a lot of the, you know, kind of similar, people are attached. Nick Zinner from the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, who did the score for Knives and Skin, is doing the score for Perpetrator. I mean, there'll be some connections. You know, I think that the people who love Knives and Skin will love Perpetrator, but I think that Perpetrator will also, you know, bring new fans. But it feels, you know, it's like, and all three of them, VHS 94, Night's End, and then Perpetrator, are all Shudder originals. So I feel like, you know, not that as a filmmaker I've ever felt like an orphan that needed a family, but I feel so much love right now from the Shudder family. It's bananas. So at the very least, they owe me like a refrigerator magnet or a t-shirt.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I definitely think so. So yeah, I will look forward to checking those out whenever they, you know, obviously as an avid horror fan, I'm a Shudder subscriber, and I'd recommend if my listeners are not currently subscribers to subscribe, and I'll definitely watch out for them. And I just thank you very much again for coming on the show. And maybe you know, once those goes up, you know, once like Perpetrator's out or Night's End, we can I can talk to you again. It's been a pleasure once again, and thank you.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Keep me on a short leash. I'm here for you.
Thank you very much.
That was my guest Jennifer there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, I'd like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest episode of New Horror Express. Remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify, as well as any other place you get good podcasts from. Plus, if you do review the show, please be sure to make it 5 stars. Otherwise, the algorithm thinks we're shit for some reason. If you want to know why, you gotta ask Apple or something, because I do not have a clue. Anyway, that is all for this time, but be sure to join me next time when I will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!